I see some familiar faces and a lot of new faces as well. As many of you know, we sponsor a regular series of events here, seminars, debates, and lectures on different social and economic issues, featuring top scholars and policy analysts. And tonight is no exception. Our program tonight, as you know, is entitled Drug War Crimes, and is co-sponsored by our good friends at the Drug Policy Alliance. Marcia Rosenbaum is in the audience here, and delighted to have a chance to work with them again. And we're also featuring the book Drug War Crimes, of the same title, by one of our speakers, Jeff Myron. And I'll say a few things about that in a minute. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, hopefully you got a packet, and you'll find information about our program. The Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, scholarly public policy research institute. We sponsor many studies. We produce lots of books and hold lots of conference and media projects. The Institute itself was started 18 years ago. And the purpose of it was to pursue research into the actual nature and consequences of government policy. And we wanted to do that regardless of existing political biases, trends, phobias, or what have you, to the best we could possibly do. We wanted to create an organization that would support scholars exploring important issues that we felt otherwise would be ignored, questions normally considered out of the box, controversial, but we thought were crucial to our understanding and effort to get to the real answers and hopefully lasting solutions. As a result, the Institute was literally started to cut through what we consider to be intellectual poverty, noise, spin of so much of public policy debate, which we thought was too heavily special interest driven. The Institute, in effect, was, we feel, a new kind of research institute, one of a kind in the public policy field in many respects because of the highly partisan nature of so many advocacy groups who may be right, may not be right, but for most people, how do you tell the difference? And so the Institute was started literally with no financial backing from any interest groups. We had no angels. We had no support from industry, labor, government, or other groups that have their own agenda. Pardon me? That's right, we're on our own angel. So in effect, we were what could be perhaps called the first garage think tank. And today we have over 140 research fellows who are involved in many, many issues, and some of them hopefully will be of interest to you here. Please also feel free, of course, to visit our website, which is at independent.org. We also, I think you'll find at the website much information about our books and many other publications, new events, media projects, and so forth. One of our publications is a quarterly journal called the Independent Review. And this particular issue I pulled out because this is actually the fall 2002 issue, and of course you can get the current one too. This one you might find of particular interest because the lead article is by Harry Levine, who's a professor of sociology at Queens College, and it's on the nature and impact of worldwide drug prohibition. It's quite a powerful study that I think you might find of interest. We also produce a weekly email newsletter, which you're also welcome to subscribe. It's free. If you're interested, just leave us your email address. We'd be happy to send it to you. In your packets, there's also a program for tonight. On the first page at the bottom, you'll see information about our next event. That will be on June 17th. It's called The Future of Iraq, Democracy or Empire. Some people suggested we should call it Debacle or Empire, maybe Debacle and Empire. Anyway, it'll feature George Bisharat, who's professor of law at Hastings College of Law, Ivan Eland, who's senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty here at the Independent Institute, James Noyes, who's research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Robert Scheer, who's a senior lecturer at the Annenberg School of Communication at USC. For tonight's program, As many of you no doubt know, each year the U.S. government spends over $30 billion on the war on drugs and arrests more than 1.5 million people annually. There are currently well over 300,000 people behind bars in the U.S. for drug violations, more than the total number of people incarcerated for all crimes in the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain combined. And despite the claims that have been made, and the drug war has been going on for many years in different ways, the questions that we're going to be discussing tonight, I think, need to be asked, such as, have current drug laws deterred drug use and reduced crime, as claims have been made? What are the real costs to the war on drugs? Is there a link between crime rates, including homicide, and the kind of resources that are spent on the drug war? Many other questions. So tonight we're quite delighted and pleased to have three outstanding experts on illicit drug policy who are here to examine some of these questions, and we welcome your questions at the end and look at some real alternatives. Our first speaker, as I mentioned before, is the author of our new book called Drug War Crimes. Jeffrey Myron is professor of economics at Boston University. He's a research fellow here. He received his PhD in economics from MIT. He's been a research fellow for the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's been a professor of economics at the University of Michigan, associate editor for the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking. His articles on drug policy have appeared in numerous scholarly journals, as well as various newspapers like the London Observer, Boston Globe, San Diego Union Tribune, and elsewhere. So I'm very pleased to introduce Jeff Myron.
Thank you very much. Bear with me 1 second. Try not to botch the technical details here. Okay, so let me start. Thank you all for coming. We certainly appreciate your interest in the topic. There we go. And we're off. So David sort of gave you the initial slide. As most of you know, drug prohibition is an incredibly important policy in the United States. Okay? It affects millions of lives every day. We lock up hundreds of thousands of people. We arrest approximately 1.5 million a year on drug-related charges. Spend tens of billions of dollars and forego billions of dollars in tax revenue that could be collected if drugs were legal instead of being prohibited. Now, of course, that policy didn't happen for absolutely no reason whatsoever. There are people who believe that current U.S. drug policy generates benefits that outweigh its costs. Okay? So the alleged benefits, according to the proponents, would include reduced drug use and abuse, lower crime, improved health and productivity, and perhaps most importantly to many people, it makes what they believe is a moral statement that says drug use is bad and that society should not tolerate drug use. Okay? So there's certainly lots of sentiment out there in favor of current policy. At the same time, there's a different view that believes that it's prohibition rather than drugs themselves that are generating much, if not most, of the harm. So according to the critics of current policy, the opponents of prohibition not only costs billions of dollars, as I mentioned, but prohibition itself is what generates crime and corruption. Prohibition is what reduces the health and productivity of drug users. Prohibition itself has numerous other side effects that we'll talk about in a few minutes. And indeed, even from the moral perspective, okay, as I'll describe later, prohibition has a number of consequences that are at least as bad, if not far worse, than any moral consequence one might attach to drug use. So what I'm going to try to do in about 30 minutes, I apologize, I might skip a slide or two to sort of stay within that time frame, is to talk about these opposing views. And I'm going to present an analysis that's based on economics, not philosophy or rights or for the most part, on morality. I'm going to talk about what are the consequences of prohibiting drugs as opposed to the consequences of allowing drugs to be legal. I'm going to do it in an economist's typical sort of nerdy fashion. I'm going to use some words that don't mean what they seem to mean and things like that. Okay? But there will basically be two parts to my discussion. First, I'm going to do what economists refer to as a positive analysis. And by a positive analysis, economists mean we're going to describe the effects of drug prohibition, whether those effects are good or bad. And ideally, a positive analysis is scientific. It's one that all economists would agree with, subject to legitimate areas of legitimate scientific uncertainty. Okay, before you get to the question of whether on net we think that the particular policy is a good policy or a bad policy compared to some alternative. And then in the second part, I'll turn to that question and talk about, given the set of effects we've described as stemming from prohibition, okay, which is a better policy, prohibition or legalization? Okay, so let me start with the positive analysis. What are the effects of prohibiting drugs? To do that, okay, we first have to be specific about what we're comparing it to. And that may seem obvious, but it's one of the points that bears a certain amount of emphasis. People who advocate not just prohibition, but lots and lots of government policies have a tendency to say there's something bad going on, therefore we must have a policy. The economics view is, well, there may be or not maybe something bad going on, but we have to ask, does the policy make those things better or worse? So what are the effects of that policy compared to some alternative? And the alternative I want to consider is full legalization. Okay, so to be specific, by prohibition, I mean a regime like the current policy in the U.S., where we criminalize the possession, the sale, the transportation, et cetera, of drugs. We enforce those laws with real penalties like long jail terms, heavy fines, and asset seizures, and we really make an effort to put those laws into practice. By legalization, for the next 15 minutes or so, I mean a regime in which we just treat drugs like any other good, whether it's toothpaste, toaster ovens, ice cream cones, Starbucks, whatever. So there would be a whole set of government policies that would apply to legalized drugs. Minimum wage laws would apply in that industry and things like that, but there are no special policies toward drugs. They're just another commodity. So there are lots of other things you might consider, okay, that are in between. I'm going to put those aside for the moment. So the starting point for the analysis is a very simple observation, which may seem trivial. Prohibition doesn't eliminate the supply or demand for drugs. Well, that seems really obvious, but it's important to emphasize, okay, because policymakers, okay, advocates of prohibition, sometimes act as though, gee, if we prohibit drugs, there won't be drugs. The problem will go away. That's patently untrue. We have to ask, how does the market operate? What occurs, given that there will be at least some market in drugs, despite the existence of prohibition. Okay? So the market doesn't go away, but prohibition may affect the market in specific ways. The assertion by sort of calmer, more rational prohibitionists is prohibition will decrease the demand for drugs. It will convince some people not to want to buy drugs in the first place, and it will raise the cost of supplying drugs, and that will mean fewer people buy drugs because of the increased cost. So I want to look at both of those claims, okay, to see whether it looks plausible that prohibition, in fact, okay, decreases demand, restricts supply, and thereby lowers consumption of drugs. So think first about the demand curve for drugs. Okay. There's no doubt that prohibition might reduce the demand for drugs. Some people might choose not to consume drugs if they're illegal, people who would otherwise use drugs, because they want to respect the law. No doubt that occurs for some people in some instances, but in and of itself, respect for the law doesn't seem to be a huge effect. We can think of zillions of laws which are very weakly obeyed because they're weakly enforced. People know that they're not likely to be sanctioned, and so in fact, people routinely violate them. A second reason people might decrease their demand for drugs is because there are real penalties associated with buying drugs. You can be arrested, you can go to jail, you can have certain assets seized, you can lose professional licenses, and things like that. Now, it's certainly true that there are many arrests for drugs, many of them for drug possession, so you might think that that aspect of prohibition would be a relatively powerful force. If you think about it, however, it's probably not. Although there are lots of arrests, there are zillions of people who buy and use drugs every day, and many of those possess drugs, buy them day after day after day after day, so a simple calculation of what's your probability of being arrested for drug possession, okay, relative, in fact, is going to get you a very, very small number. In addition, despite some of the occasional horror stories, most of the time the penalties for mere possession of drugs are quite mild. Okay, and so it seems unlikely to me that, in fact, prohibition reduces the demand for drugs in and of itself to any substantial degree. So in my analysis, the effect on demand is plausibly pretty small. possibly more convincing argument is that prohibition raises the cost of supplying drugs, and then even if it hasn't shifted demand, okay, it will lead to a higher price, and that may persuade a lot of people from wanting to buy drugs, okay, from consuming drugs. So it's clearly the case that prohibition does increase certain costs of supplying drugs. Black market drug suppliers have to hide their activities, they have to bribe officials, they transport the drugs in secret, they may have to compensate their employees at higher than normal rates because when you work in the illegal drug trade, you risk getting shot and incarcerated and things like that. Okay. Nevertheless, I think the effect of prohibition on supply is not necessarily as large as it's frequently made out to be. Okay. Black market suppliers, okay, although they do face increased costs from one perspective, actually have a cost advantage relative to legal suppliers from a different perspective, given you're operating in secret, that you're staying away from the police. As a black market supplier, you're not going to comply with excise taxes, minimum wage laws, child labor laws, environmental regulation, and zillions of other things. So that, to some extent, offsets the increased costs due to prohibition. And so the question is then, well, what is the evidence? How big an effect do we expect prohibition to have on the consumption of drugs? So my assessment is that looking at the body of evidence, and as summarized in the book in some detail, there's a lot of evidence that prohibition has some effect, but very little evidence that it has a substantial effect. Okay, so to give you a few examples, okay, over the past 20, 25 years in the United States, the attempts to enforce drug prohibition have escalated enormously. Okay, we're arresting way more people, we're incarcerating, you know, four or five times more people than we were 25 years ago. We're spending four times as much money for the drug czar's office and things like that. Yet drug prices, okay, have fallen by a factor of about 80%. If prohibition is an effective policy, if it's useful for raising the cost of supplying drugs, that's exactly the opposite of what one would expect to see. And in fact, the decline in drug prices has been dramatic. If you look at differences across countries, okay, some countries enforce their drug laws very strictly, such as the U.S. and a few other places. Many other countries, such as Europe, Canada, although they enforce them to some degree, enforce them way less than the United States. So if prohibition is an effective policy, you'd expect to see the countries with weak enforcement have a lot higher rates of drug use than the countries with strict enforcement. That, in fact, is not the case. Rates of drug use bear no correlation to the degree of enforcement of drug prohibition. So based on those two pieces of evidence and a number of others that I discuss in the book, okay, my conclusion is that both theory and evidence suggest the effect of prohibition on drug use is probably modest, not zero. Okay, sometimes legalizers fall in the trap of just asserting that it's zero, that there can't be any effect. There probably is some effect, but it's 20% or 30%, maybe it's 50%. It's not 5,000% or 5 million percent, as is often asserted by prohibitionists. So why is prohibition such a big deal if it's not having a huge effect on the amount of drug consumption? It's having a huge effect. It's a big deal, excuse me, because it creates a black market. And in a black market, a whole bunch of things happen, okay, that wouldn't happen in a legal market, okay, and that are potentially very costly for society. Okay, so what I want to talk about next are all the things that happen, okay, as a result of prohibition above and beyond any effect of reducing drug consumption. First, okay, and quite importantly, is the effect of prohibition in increasing violence. Okay. The standard claim that you will see in the newspaper over and over and over again on the ONDC, on the Drug Czar's website and all sorts of other places, is that drug use makes people violent. Okay. In fact, okay, there's almost no evidence to support that claim, that merely consuming drugs makes you go out and do violent things or criminogen or other criminal things. Okay. The much more plausible effect, okay, is in the other direction. The prohibition itself creates violence because the participants in a black market, okay, cannot resolve their disputes using lawyers and arbitration systems and judges. Okay. They have to resort to guns or knives or and other forms of violence because they don't have access to the nonviolent legal dispute resolution system. And there's a huge amount of evidence which is consistent with this view that I've just enunciated, rather than the traditional view that drugs themselves cause violence. If you look at the history of alcohol and drug prohibition in the United States, the periods in which the U.S. has had elevated rates of violence are the periods in which we've tried to vigorously enforce alcohol and drug prohibition. If you look across countries, countries that have high rates of violence are, other things equal, the countries that attempt to enforce drug prohibition to a substantial degree. If you look across a whole range of other commodities, gambling, prostitution, tires, sugar, blue jeans in the Soviet Union, any cases where, because of war, because of a centralized economy, prices have not been allowed to be free and there's been a black market, okay, you've always seen violence associated with those commodities, okay, independent of the characteristics of the commodity. And there's a number of additional pieces of evidence to that effect. So that's one key effect of prohibition. Prohibition itself generates violence. A second possible effect, okay, is generating crime more generally. Okay? The main mechanism by which that might happen is that prohibition raises drug prices, as we've discussed. Although, as I've discussed, I'm not convinced that that's such an enormous effect, although it's certainly not a zero effect. If prohibition raises drug prices, then there's more incentive for people who use drugs, low-income persons who use drugs, to commit theft, robbery, other income-generating crime to be able to afford their drug habits. A second reason prohibition might generate crime more generally is that prohibition diverts the police from trying to deter standard crimes such as murder, robbery, rape, arson, etc., because the police are busy, preoccupied, trying to deter drug crime. The evidence is consistent with this view, with both of these mechanisms. It's not as clear-cut, in my assessment, as the evidence on violence, but it's certainly some evidence to support that. Another effect of prohibition, again, whether or not it reduces drug use, is that prohibition redistributes society's resources to people who have chosen to be criminals. In a legal market, some of the income that's generated accrues to the government in the form of taxes or to the ownership as profits. In a black market, there are no taxes, so all of that profit goes to the suppliers. Okay? To be technical, that's not a cost, okay, in the strict economic sense, it's a redistribution. It enriches drug suppliers relative to drug consumers, but it's obviously a kind of redistribution that no one would ever endorse if they actually knew it was going on. If you put on a ballot initiative, do you want to have a policy which enriches criminals? Obviously, most people would vote against it, and yet that's exactly what's happening as a result of drug prohibition, okay, with the consent, unfortunately, of a substantial fraction of the populace. Still, another important effect of prohibition is diminished quality control. In black markets, you can't sue manufacturers for faulty goods, you can't complain to the FTC or the Consumer Product Safety Commission, manufacturers can't advertise to promote their high-quality products, and manufacturers want to transport drugs in relatively pure forms of the drug. All those factors mean that quality control, ability of people to get a commodity whose purity they understand and whose content they understand is greatly inhibited in a black market, and so you get more overdoses and accidental poisonings relative to what you would see in a legal market. Prohibition is likely to increase corruption. In a legal market, we see campaign contributions, we see lobbying, okay? That can't happen in a black market, and so you're going to get corruption of police, of law enforcement officials, of politicians, okay, via bribes and corruption, which you wouldn't see in a legal market for drugs. Let me mention a few things very quickly, okay, other effects of prohibition. Okay? Because prohibition is a victimless crime, there's a strong incentive for the police to want to restrict the notions of civil liberties because it's hard to enforce crimes against consensual activities without impinging on those civil liberties, so the police use more invasive tactics. Again, because the police have to enforce a consensual crime, a crime that doesn't have a victim, there's increased incentive to use racial profiling. Because of the restrictions on clean needles fostered by prohibition, there's increased spread of HIV and other bloodborne diseases. Because the prohibitionists are worried about anybody getting access to drugs, they're forced to push restrictions on the medicinal uses of drugs. So we see relatively limited access, except under a few state laws for medical marijuana. We see doctors being pressured not to use opiates for the alleviation of pain of cancer patients and other people who are suffering from all sorts of extremely painful and debilitating diseases. Prohibition makes it much more complicated just to conduct all sorts of other policies because our negotiations, say, with Mexico over free trade can't just be about free trade. We have to worry about if we allow free trade, is that going to make it easier for more drugs to get into the country? So let me summarize what I've said so far quickly. Prohibition probably does reduce consumption of drugs to some degree, but neither theory nor evidence suggests a large effect, and indeed, a substantial part of the effect may be on relatively casual consumers about whom people tend to be less concerned than heavy consumers. Whether or not prohibition reduces consumption very much, it has a whole range of other effects. And those effects are things that we need to think about, not just the effects on drug consumption. So I want to turn now, okay, to the normative analysis. Is drug prohibition good or bad compared to legalizing drugs? What almost everyone would agree to is that almost all the effects I've discussed so far, okay, are bad. Okay? There's some room for reasonable scientific disagreement about certain magnitudes and maybe in a few cases about whether I've gotten the sign of the effect right, but I don't think there's very much of that. Anybody who agrees with my analysis, nevertheless, would agree that having a policy which increases crime and violence, transfers resources to criminals, spreads HIV, et cetera, anyone who agreed with those conclusions from the positive analysis would, of course, agree that those are undesirable effects of prohibition and would, other things equal, oppose those effects and presumably oppose the policy. But there's one critical exception to that view, which is any effect of prohibition in reducing drug consumption. Okay? Some people clearly think that reducing drug consumption is a good idea, okay, and that that's the reason we want prohibition, and they might be willing to trade off some other negative effects, some other bad things, okay, in exchange for being able to reduce drug consumption. So that's a critical question which the normative analysis, okay, has to address. Okay? If you think that prohibition reduces drug consumption minimally, then the analysis really isn't very hard. You're getting all these bad effects and not reducing drug consumption, so end of story. If you think that drug prohibition is reducing drug consumption to a moderate degree, and you think that that's a good thing, okay, then you have a harder balancing to undertake. So what I'm going to do in the remaining part of the talk is discuss four different perspectives on how policy should treat drug consumption. Okay? I'm not going to talk about whether drug consumption is good or bad. The question is whether the policy of attempting to reduce drug consumption does more harm than good, taking into account all the effects. And there are really two separate questions, and a point that is frequently overlooked. The first question is, should some policy be used in the attempt to reduce drug consumption? Secondly, if the answer is yes, is the right policy prohibition or possibly something else? So let me start with a view that I refer to as rational drug consumption. The standard economic model, which economists use over and over and over again to study the demand for toothpaste or the market for personal computers or whatever, says people buy things because they want to. Okay? They choose to do one thing as opposed to another because they think it makes them better off. And so people buy drugs because they want to buy drugs, because they like consuming drugs, because it helps, it's a form of self-medication, because it makes you look cool, because you enjoy being intoxicated or whatever. In the standard rational economic model, it doesn't matter why people choose to consume drugs. It doesn't matter whether drugs are addictive or if drugs can sometimes be harmful. That doesn't distinguish drugs from zillions of other commodities. Okay? All that matters is that people are voluntarily choosing to accept the risks of using drugs because they think it makes them better off. Okay, now, before I continue, let me emphasize my overall bottom line doesn't rely on the assertion that everybody's drug use is rational, okay? But I think that that's a perspective that's useful to think about. Okay? If you take that perspective, okay, then the analysis of drug prohibition is really easy, because if you think that all drug consumption is rational, not only is policy having all of these negative effects of creating crime and corruption, but it's preventing people who wish to use drugs from obtaining the benefit of so doing, and thereby making them worse off, okay, as well. And even if one can point to situations where drug use seems to be irrational to sort of almost any observer, it's hard to deny that a lot of drug use, in fact, seems just as rational as anything else. It's hard to distinguish why some people's use of marijuana is any different than other people's use of alcohol, why some people's use of cocaine for the short-term enjoyment that they get is any better or worse than other people's short-term enjoyment from using alcohol or engaging in sporting activities or anything else. So one cost of prohibition under this view is any reduction in drug use by persons who would use drugs responsibly if drugs were legal, okay? And that's not a bizarre argument. It's the same argument we make for keeping alcohol, cigarettes, cars, Ben and Jerry's ice cream, and millions of other things legal, okay, which all of which have a characteristic that they can be misused and they can cause harm if misused, but for the vast majority of users, they're not misused and they provide enjoyment to the people who use them. So that's one possible perspective on drug use, and I think it leads to the conclusion that some of the reduction in drug use achieved by policy is in fact a cost of policy of prohibition, not a benefit. A second perspective, referred to as paternalism, asserts that many drug users are myopic or irrational, they don't know what they're doing, they're not properly taking into account the future consequences of drug use, and so policy should discourage drug use to protect people from themselves. Okay? It's, of course, you know, impossible to deny that some degree of myopia irrationality exists with respect to drugs and many other commodities, okay, but that does not by itself imply that a policy intervention is necessarily desirable, and certainly not that prohibition is necessarily desirable. So why not? Well, first of all, okay, the paternalistic view opens a Pandora's box of government interventions. Once you've said government should be in the business of deciding what's good or bad for people, okay, then government has the authority to choose a whole range of things, from what books you should read to how much exercise you should get, and a whole host of other things that I personally would have very, very strong objection to. And there's no presumption that governments get it right. Okay? Any objective assessment of marijuana versus alcohol would say that alcohol is the more serious commodity, and yet policy has chosen to prohibit marijuana, not alcohol. A second objection to the paternalistic approach, justification for policy interventions or for reducing drug use, is that the underlying assumptions, while not wrong, okay, are frequently grotesquely exaggerated and in particular don't differentiate drugs from a host of currently legal goods. It's certainly true that drug use can be addictive. It's certainly true that drug use can be harmful. It's certainly true that some drug users are myopic. But is that more true for drugs than it is for alcohol or undersaving or not spending enough time on your kids' homework or watching too much late-night TV or a zillion other things? There's no reason to think that the degree of these problems is any more serious for drugs than it is for a host of other things. In addition, if you attempt to reduce drug use, you may simply encourage people to consume some other thing, which is just as bad for them, and then you've had no net effect in any event, even if all of those things, in fact, are potentially quite harmful. Okay. Finally, even if you grant all the assumptions behind the paternalistic perspective and think that that implies some type of intervention by government to help protect myopic drug users from themselves, it doesn't imply prohibition. The right question is not, does the existence of myopia justify prohibition? The right way to think about it is, what policy will balance the negatives of myopia against the negatives of policy? We've discussed that prohibition has an enormous range of undesirable consequences and isn't particularly effective at reducing drug use. So there's just no reason to think that on net, the benefit of sometimes reducing myopic drug use could possibly justify the enormous costs that prohibition imposes on society. Other approaches, possibly subsidized treatment, possibly public information campaigns, possibly sin taxes or things like that, might have a reasonable ratio of benefits to cost, but prohibition almost certainly does not. Another perspective on possible reason that you might think government should intervene to discourage the use of drugs is that they're externalities, another economics term that I will attempt to explain. Okay? Externalities means their effects on innocent third parties. When I do something, it negatively impacts you, even though you haven't volunteered to be impacted by my actions. So if people consume drugs when they're pregnant, that may adversely affect an unborn fetus. If people consume drugs and drive, that may cause traffic or industrial accidents and the like. If people make themselves sick and use publicly funded health care, that's potentially an example of an externality. So again, one certainly can't deny that drug use can cause externalities. There's no room for debate about that. It does occur in some instances. But again, the mere existence of those externalities does not imply that there's a role for policy, and especially not for prohibition. So again, the magnitude of externalities, okay, from drugs is frequently highly exaggerated and, if assessed objectively, is not obviously different from that of many legal goods, whether it's alcohol, saturated fat, watching too much late night TV and therefore being unproductive at work, or lots and lots of other things that one can think of. Okay? There's again the problem that attempts to reduce the use of one good that can cause externality, such as driving under the influence of marijuana, might cause you to drive under the influence of alcohol, which, according to many controlled studies, actually has a bigger negative effect on your ability to drive. It's also the case that calculating net externalities is very tricky. Okay? Many of you may be aware that people have attempted to see whether smokers are imposing a big externality on everyone else by making excessive use of publicly funded health care. It turns out that, yes, smokers do use more publicly funded health care on average while they're alive, but they tend to die young. So they collect less Social Security and less Medicare on average than non-smokers, so in fact, they seem to approximately be paying their way. That sounds really heartless, but if you're going to take this approach, if you're going to rely on the externality argument, you should be consistent, and that means accepting conclusions such as the possibility that government policy should be subsidizing tobacco use or at least reducing taxes, okay, rather than the other way around. It doesn't always have to come out that to show that more policy intervention is better. Excuse me. Finally, on externalities, again, the right question is not whether externalities exist. There's no doubt that they exist. The right question is, does a particular policy have more of an effect in reducing externalities, have a benefit in reducing externalities relative to the cost generated by that policy? In the case of prohibition, we know that it has enormous costs, and therefore the chance that it's reducing externalities more than it itself is causing those externalities is very remote. There's no reason to think that the benefits exceed the cost. There are other approaches that are far more likely to make sense. Finally, a possible perspective on why policy should attempt to reduce drug use is a moral perspective. According to some, drug use is inherently immoral or against religious views or in some way evil, so policy should prohibit drugs to make a moral statement, even if that policy has substantial cost. Skip over it just a little bit. Okay. Well, what's wrong with that view? Well, first of all, unless you put an infinite weight on making this moral statement, you should still be willing to consider all the other effects of prohibition. You might think that it's good for policy to signal that drug use is undesirable, but you shouldn't be willing to do that at any cost, okay? And so you should recognize all the other arguments that I've raised here today. Okay? Even more importantly, if you accept my analysis, prohibition is at least as immoral, in my view, far, far more immoral than legalization and drug use, okay? Because it has enormous effects which negatively impact innocent bystanders. There's increased violence generated by prohibition, some of which leads people walking down the street to get caught in drive-by shootings. There's increased crime, which means the police are not protecting you in your homes as well as they might be because they're out locking somebody up because he was caught with a joint in his pocket. Okay? There are restrictions on civil liberties. There's the prevention of marijuana and opiates being used to treat people who are sick because of the desire to enforce prohibition. There's the reduced respect for the law that's generated by any policy that has anything like the degree of noncompliance that prohibition laws do in the United States. There's the encouragement of the view that people aren't accountable for their actions, that it's the drugs that made them do it, that's a consequence of prohibition. And that, to me, is also an immoral consequence of prohibition. So I don't think that the moral view carries the day for the prohibitionists. Far from it. I think it goes in just the opposite direction. So to summarize, anyone who accepts the economic analysis I provided would agree that virtually all the effects of prohibition are undesirable, with the only possible exception being any reduction in drug consumption that's achieved by prohibition. Even that is partly a cost, as long as you're willing to assume that some people can use drugs rationally and responsible, okay, assuming drugs were legal. Okay? Most importantly, even if there's a case for policy to attempt to reduce drug consumption because of myopia, because of externalities, prohibition is almost certainly the worst possible approach for doing that. Other far less interventionist policies would have a much better ratio of benefits to cost than the current analysis of prohibition. Okay, let me just sum up, which I think I sort of already did. Okay, the bottom line, sort of the broader perspective is simply policies have a range of consequences, intended and unintended. Okay? Rational analysis of any policy, including drug prohibition, should consider all of the consequences, not just the feel-good consequences, not just the consequences that politicians want to occur, or that the voters want to occur, but all the consequences that actually will occur. Okay? So it's clearly true that there are unknowns about legalization. We don't know exactly how much drug use would change, okay, or what norms would develop about drug use, how it might affect certain parts of society. Okay? But there is no evidence which makes an overall case that the benefits of prohibition exceeds a cost. In fact, the evidence is strongly to the contrary. So despite the unknowns, far and away the most appealing policy is to legalize drugs, okay, and to do it sooner rather than later. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. During the Q&A, if those of you who are interested, you can pursue questions about specifics pertaining to Jeff's findings on the effects of the war on drugs on homicide rates and other issues.